Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Unexpected Elements is the podcast shining a light on the science lurking behind the news.
We know lots of scientists and we're not afraid to call them up.
Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 6th of September, these are our main stories. The former leader of the Proud Boys far-right group in the United States has been sentenced to 22 years in jail for his role in the attack on the US Capitol in January 2021. Spain's Football Federation has sacked the head coach of its World Cup-winning women's team, a close ally of Luis Rubiales, the suspended president. The army in Burkina Faso says 17 soldiers and 36 volunteer fighters have been killed in clashes with Islamist militants. Also in this podcast.
Right now, New York is one of the top tourist destinations in the world. And at least looking back over the last decade, Airbnb has been a pretty significant part of the tourist accommodation landscape.
But now officials in the city say that visitors will only be able to book such accommodation for a maximum of 2 guests. And the host must be present during the stay. We begin in Washington. The former leader of the far-right Proud Boys militia has been sentenced to 22 years in prison for his role in the attack on the US Capitol by supporters of Donald Trump. Enrique Tarrio was not in Washington on January the 6th, 2021, but was accused of directing the military-style assault on the Capitol by members of the Proud Boys. I spoke to our correspondent Wira Davis, who was outside the court in Washington.
The prosecution, remember, had asked for a sentence of 33 years. The judge said that kind of sentence is usually handed down to somebody responsible for a terrorist attack, blowing up a building, or an attack in which several people are killed. Therefore, he wasn't going to hand down a sentence of that level. But mindful of the violent events of January the 6th, of course, events in which 5 people did actually lose their lives, he said that Tarrio should be sentenced to 22 years in jail. Because he was quite clearly the orchestrator, the organiser of what the judge called a seditious conspiracy. That conspiracy was, of course, to stop the peaceful transfer, the constitutional transfer of power from one president to another. The Proud Boys had gone to the Capitol that day, along with other pro-Trump groups like the Oath Keepers, in order to try and stop Mike Pence, who was the vice president, from formally accepting the votes of the 2020 election in the Electoral College and handing over power to Joe Biden. They clearly wanted to stop that happening violently, and despite what was a very contritious speech by Tarrio himself on the stand, in which he expressed remorse for what he'd done, the judge nonetheless said that he was clearly the leader of this conspiracy and sent him down for 22 years.
Now, Wira, this was the last of the high-profile prosecutions over the January the 6th riots, until the biggest of them all, of course, Donald Trump's.
Yeah, I mean, what's really interesting about this case is that Enrique Tarrio wasn't present in Washington, D.C. on that day because he'd been arrested and banned from the city 2 days earlier. So his argument that he wasn't present at the Capitol didn't really help him. Now, you remember that Donald Trump is due to appear on his own charges, not quite such serious charges of seditious conspiracy, but he is due to appear on his own charges of trying to overturn and deny the result of the 2020 election. Part of Trump's defence thus far has been that he wasn't present at the Capitol. He was further down the mall. But of course, we all heard, and the prosecution said, everybody heard Donald Trump encouraging his supporters, including the Proud Boys, to go down and to march on the Capitol. So that defence that Donald Trump might want to use when he appears here at this federal courthouse I'm standing in front of in March, that defence that he wasn't here at the time might not work in his favour.
Sorry for the sound quality on that. We caught Wira just after the sentencing was made there in Washington. Spain's football coach has been key to the remarkable growth of women's football. The national team has, of course, just won the World Cup. So it might seem a strange time for the Football Federation there to sack Jorge Vilda. But that is exactly what's just happened. He's been replaced by a woman, a former member of the national team, Montse Tome. The context to this is, of course, that Mr. Vilda is considered to be a close ally of Luis Rubiales, the suspended president of the Football Federation, who has been under fire for kissing the player Jenny Hermoso on the lips without her consent as the team celebrated winning the tournament. This is the reaction to the sacking of the Spanish football coach.
It seems to me that it has come at the wrong time and that it is always insufficient. With this issue, we have to be much more cautious. We have to be much tougher, and this kind of thing must not happen. So, well, we still need much more, not just to dismiss one man, but to ensure that this kind of behaviour is not centralised in general, not only what has happened to this girl, but what has happened to all of us.
Others felt Jorge Vilda's success at the World Cup demonstrated he'd done some good by the team, but acknowledged he had to go.
It's late and it's what had to be done, especially if the girls are unhappy with him. Despite as much as he has achieved, which is an impressive and maximum level of success as a coach.
Guillaume Balaguer is a Spanish football journalist. Tim Franks asked him why the Spanish Federation has sacked Jorge Vilda now.
I hear many people saying, but why didn't this happen before? You know, things at Palace go very, very slowly. And obviously in a federation that is a private institution, they have their own laws and their own rules. They had to go through a legal process, in fact, to get rid of Jorge Vilda, which in a way, it was the easiest of those heads that have to fall. Quite clearly, the players have shown their opposition to those decision makers. They didn't name them, but included Vilda. They had protested in the past against his methods. What is more surprising, if you like, is that that came hand in hand with a statement by Pedro Rocha, the new temporary president, installed by Rubiales, the former president. But that statement is quite strong in terms of, you know, talking about structural changes are needed. And we all hope that Vilda going is the beginning of those changes.
The statement from the Football Federation about the firing of Vilda, all it did was sort of say, yes, we're going to dispense with his services, but what a great man he is. There's no explanation for why they're getting rid of him.
You want black and white. You want the villain to be an absolutely total villain. But you know what? Things are a little bit more complex than that because he's won the World Cup. He created a coaching staff that helped the national team to get to winning a World Cup, considering that 15 players a year and a half earlier, I decided not to join him. And out of those 15, which were supposed to be the best players we had, only three went to Australia. So if you look at it from only that point of view, you think he has done a good job. But of course, when you start scratching a little bit deeper, what you see is that the players have not liked his methods for a long time. They have been complaining, but what happens when women complain about where they work? And the bosses are with those that take decisions. They're not heard. By getting Vilda, you're sending the message that we do care, we're listening now.
The big question is, what about Rubiales himself? Why is he still there?
He's suspended by FIFA, but yeah, his shadow is very long. I'm going to put you the hellish proposition, which is that on the 24th of November, FIFA, who have suspended him for 3 months, as you know, haven't resolved his case yet. And he then stops being suspended. And he says, OK, well, I want my job back. While there are other journeys, judicial journeys and sporting journeys and political journeys, trying to get rid of him.
But why doesn't the Football Federation just get rid of him?
That's a good question, because they have the power to do that. All they said is, we want you to resign, knowing full well that he wouldn't. They're saying, of course, now that they're embarrassed by his behaviour, but the mechanism they've got to get rid of him is a vote of no confidence. The problem is, Rocha has been chosen by Rubiales. And let's say that he actually wants to get rid of him through a vote of no confidence. He knows everybody else in that table that will be part of that decision. And many of them are Rubiales people.
Guillaume Balaguer, a Spanish football journalist. The army in Burkina Faso says 17 soldiers and 36 volunteer fighters have been killed during heavy clashes with Islamist militants in the north of the country, near the border with Mali. Extremist fighters linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group have been carrying out frequent attacks since 2015. More details from our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
A statement from the army in Burkina Faso mentioned brave, fearless troops putting up fierce resistance and repelling what it called a terrorist attack. It also said dozens of enemy fighters were killed. It's hard to verify exactly what took place in this remote area close to the border with Mali, but the admission that 53 members of the security forces were killed by the Islamist extremists makes this yet another grim day for Burkina Faso's military. The men who carried out two coups last year and then forced French troops to leave now appear to be turning to Russia in a bid to stop the insurgency from spreading further across the country.
Will Ross. It has been 2 years since the Taliban took over in Afghanistan. And since then, more than 8,000 LGBTQ plus people have made requests to the NGO Rainbow Railroad for help to leave the country. The BBC's Bertin Hun met one of those people who made it out of the country. He's now living in the UK.
Really young, I knew that this is not the kind of place and environment that I should be open or out, even though there were times that I was just being me.
That's Layla, not their real name.
I had to drop school like literally 2 weeks before the final exams. I had to stop going to school because it was violent.
Their family didn't accept them.
They did their own version of conversion therapy, which was me drinking this black liquid, which is called Surma, which is like mostly people in South Asian countries put it on their eyes to make it like more black. But the effect of that is it makes your voice more masculine.
Life in Afghanistan wasn't easy for Layla, but in August 2021, Kabul fell to the Taliban.
I was like, okay, this is Kabul, it's not going to happen. Like, woke up the next morning, I saw the Taliban, like, literally with all their outfits, long beard.
And life got much more dangerous.
Do not look flamboyant, do not put on jeans or anything. I was wearing the traditional clothes. I was about to open the car and someone hit me really bad. Like, I hurt my bones. Like, and I looked back and that was a Taliban. My eyes were almost full of tears and I was like, why? And he said, like, don't you know how to walk like a man? If I react any way that he wouldn't like it, he would definitely shoot me on the spot.
It was clear to them they had to leave the country.
And there was another female friend of mine. So she was with me like, okay, you're the husband, I'm the wife, and we're going to pass through the security checks. We could see how they were picking people out of the lines. So like, you're coming out with us, you're coming out with us. We waited at the airport, then, yeah, we flew out. At least I know that I won't be killed today.
The Rainbow Railroad is the organization that supported Layla on this journey. Their name is a nod to the Underground Railroad, the historical network that helped enslave Africans flee the U.S.
So far, we have successfully relocated 417 individuals of Afghan nationality.
Earlier, I caught up with Devin Matthews from the Rainbow Railroad.
They fill out a form that kind of contains basic information around their history and story of persecution, the current situation they're in, and their biographical information, and do a deep dive into verifying the information that they've given us.
People like Layla, the organization works with governments to relocate LGBTQ plus people in safer countries.
We have to layer that vulnerability and triaging assessment on top of availability of pathways to support people.
Layla is now living in the UK. Britain has helped him live authentically in the open.
I go to uni, I'm doing a master's degree. I got a scholarship for uni. I study, I work. It's great. I'm dating a guy.
That report was by Bertin Hoon. New York City officials have introduced legislation which, in effect, bans holiday rentals lasting less than 30 days. The move is an attempt to ensure affordable housing is available to New York residents and to curb antisocial behaviour. Well, visitors can now only hire homes through platforms like Airbnb for a maximum of 2 guests, and the host must live there and be present during the stay. It's expected that thousands of homes will be removed from websites from Tuesday. Failure to comply with the legislation could result in up to $5,000 in fines per stay. Well, Ben Thompson spoke to Dr. David Walksmith, Associate Professor of Urban Planning at McGill University in Montreal. He's researched the impact of Airbnb on New York extensively.
Right now, New York is one of the top tourist destinations in the world. And at least looking back over the last decade, Airbnb has been a pretty significant part of the tourist accommodation landscape. But the fact is that unlike a lot of, let's say, smaller towns, kind of resort destinations that really rely on home sharing to ensure an adequate supply of tourist accommodations, New York's not exactly hurting for hotels. So if the change in rules results in many thousands of Airbnbs being deactivated, as I think most people expect it will, it's still going to amount to not much more than a drop in the bucket in terms of the overall flow of visitors who come to the city every year.
So that's the impact on New York. Talk to me about the impact on Airbnb itself, because we know New York City, a huge generator of revenue for that firm.
That's right. And if you go back about a decade ago, New York was the second or third largest market for Airbnb alongside London and Paris. But that hasn't been true for some time now. And part of the reason for that is that, frankly, the city government's been at war with Airbnb for this last decade, trying to find a way to enforce what they see as the kind of longstanding rules prohibiting commercial short-term rentals in the city. So Airbnb is definitely going to be hurting from the loss of business. But the days where New York was one of their most significant markets actually are somewhat in the past at this point.
Dr. David Wachsmuth from McGill University in Montreal. Well, Airbnb argues that the change will be bad for tourism. Still to come.
There are challenges around the capture and movement. This is something rhino conservationists have developed very strong technical experience in over time.
The great white rhino release, 2000, will go from captivity into the wild. But how do we make sure it's good news for the species and not just for the poachers?
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Money laundering operations.
A cyber criminal group.
These are smart guys.
Seasons 1 and 2 of The Lazarus Heist from the BBC World Service are available in full right now.
Following the twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
The Lazarus Heist from the BBC World Service. Catch up with the whole series now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, what's in a name? Well, a lot of trouble, it seems, at least in India. Or should that be Bharat? That is the question now causing a stir, because invitations sent out by the Indian president in advance of the G20 summit referred to Bharat, not India. Well, Bharat is widely used domestically in India, and the name is mentioned in the constitution. But opposition parties say any attempt to change the country's identity would amount to distorting history. I asked our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Etarajan, why Bharat was mentioned on this invitation.
Now, I've seen the photograph of this invitation on social media, which says the president of Bharat, which is quite unusual because this invitation is to all the dignitaries who are coming for the G20 summit this weekend. And now the Indian media is saying that this is the first time the Indian president has used this word Bharat in an official invitation. Now, that has triggered a huge debate, in fact, controversy in India. The social media is on fire with why people should be using whether Bharat or India. Now, these two names are being used interchangeably in India itself. If you look at the official word, the Prime Minister of India, the President of India, but India is also known as Bharat. For example, people who speak, especially in northern India, where the Hindi, where they will use as Bharat, which is a very common term, whereas non-Hindi speakers might use the word India more. If you look at the Constitution of India, the first article would say, India, that is Bharat, shall be a union of states. So the both were being interchangeably used. But now the issue is, the Hindu nationalists have been calling for the name change for a long time. That is what has triggered this controversy with opposition parties, especially the Congress Party and others are saying this is an attempt to impose a particular ideology, and already India name is there. You are distorting history by changing the name to Bharat.
So the Indian President's office has chosen this very high profile time to make this quite strong statement. Some people are supporting it, saying, look, it marks the end of the slave mentality. But not everyone sees it like that, of course.
No, many people, especially, as you say, like Hindu nationalists and their supporters would prefer the name Bharat. But Bharat is a name being used by everyone during a normal day-to-day discussion. But I have to say, there has been no official response from the government of India, whether they want to change India's name to Bharat. Only the president's office invitation is the only clue. But some of the ministers have been coming out and talking in support of why should we have the name India, which is a colonial invention, which many people can contest. And we should now change to our name to Bharat, which has been mentioned in the ancient Indian text. That is raising a lot of questions about people asking, OK, so what will you do about Indian Ocean? How will you call it now? Or if it is a Reserve Bank of India, which is a central bank, how would you call that now? So these are some of the questions being raised. And what is the need to change? Because India is well known outside the country. Globally, India is known. Now, if you're going to change Bharat, that's going to, you know, have an impact on the brand name India itself.
Ambarasan Etarajan. Africa's first climate summit is taking place in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The talks are focusing on mobilising finance for the continent's response to climate change. Whilst Africa is suffering from some of the most severe impacts of climate change, the continent only receives about 12% of the money it needs to cope. Meanwhile, communities living around Lake Baringo in Kenya's Great Rift Valley have filed the first class action of its kind in the country. They're suing the government over the adverse effects of climate change. Water levels have doubled over the past decade, displacing thousands of people. Government officials have not responded to the BBC's request for comments. Mercy Juma reports.
It's a refreshing morning. The sun is a beautiful golden yellow ball rising from the rolling hills as rays shine on the vast fresh waters of Lake Baringo. The fishermen's boats dot the calm, gleaming water. I notice one of them limping. Joseph Atuma tells me he is a victim of a hippo attack.
The water level is high. Lake animals come close to the shores. That is where the problem is. It gives us less room to maneuver. By the time you run away, they attack, and there is no way to escape.
A few kilometers behind me, there were people's homes, there were schools, there were hospitals. But you cannot really tell any of those things existed because they have all been swallowed by the lake. And people have been pushed out of this place. They are now living elsewhere, but they still come back. There are women who are washing their laundry here, oblivious of the fact that this water is now heavily infested by crocodiles, and they do attack them sometimes. On the shores, women are busy cleaning up their fish as stealthy, deadly predators, the Nile crocodiles, swim nearby. Be careful, one woman warns.
People in this area have a lot of tales around loss and damage linked to the rising waters of Lake Baringo. And I'm going to meet a woman who lost not only her land, her home, but also lost her leg when she was attacked by a crocodile.
Winnie Keben is a 29-year-old mother of six. She warmly welcomes me and offers a seat outside her grass-thatched mud house. I was dragged into the lake. My leg was broken. The crocodile took away part of it, she says as she shows me her prosthetic leg. The incessant waters have taken even more from her, flooding her home and farmland.
A long time ago, we would farm and get our food. Nowadays, when it rains, we experience loss and destruction. We are praying that God will help us so that the lake does not swell further and displace us again, because we have nowhere else to go.
Environmentalists say the lake has doubled in size over the last decade because of heavy rainfall linked to climate change. For the first time, communities here have sued the government for failing to respond to the climate change crisis. Benson Chepkonga is a representative of the communities.
We are representing the larger majority of Baringo. We expect a fair ruling. We expect
a fair compensation, and we expect them to come and renovate even schools, even the bridges and other public utilities that have been destructed.
According to the United Nations Environment Programme, climate change court cases have more than doubled globally in the last 5 years as communities seek action and justice. Omondi Owino is an international environment lawyer who is handling the case.
We have not seen anything like this on the African continent. That makes it quite significant. When the court finally makes a determination, it might become a path-breaking precedent in the area of climate change law, not only for Kenya, but it will be quoted also globally and in other African countries.
The tales of loss and damage from the swelling lake are chilling. The residents talk of an unknown number of people, including children, being dragged into the waters, never to be seen again. Many of them have nowhere to relocate to, and every day the risks of staying here increases.
That report was by Mercy Juma in Kenya. A new computer analysis tool built by the UN suggests that around 6 billion tonnes of sand is dredged from the world's oceans annually, endangering marine life and coastal communities. The UN's Environment Agency says some dredging vessels were acting as vacuum cleaners, extracting both sand and microorganisms that fish feed on. The agency's spokesman, Pascal Peduzzi, said the current situation was unsustainable for marine life.
The impact on the fishes are tremendous. The fact that you are removing all the bottom of the sea and it's changing, there is no more life there. The life needs to come back, so you need to allow time to come back. If you don't take all the sand, if you leave like 50, 60 centimeters of sand, life can come back. But if you are taking all the sand to the bare rock, then it's a different status and the life may not recover.
Scientists say sand is amongst the most exploited natural resource in the world, used in the production of concrete and glass. Now, to what seems to be good news for the white rhino. There are about 16,000 of them still left in the world, mostly in South Africa. 2,000 of them have been enclosed there in a fenced reserve as part of a breeding programme. But now it's been announced that they will be gradually reintroduced into the wild over a 10-year period. Joe Shaw of the conservation group Save the Rhino International told me that with the release of these animals, the hard work begins.
There are challenges around the capture and movement, kind of the logistics of the translocations. This is something rhino conservationists have developed very strong technical experience in over time. Perhaps the bigger scale challenge is ensuring there are safe, secure areas with good habitat that can be maintained and financed for them into the future going forward, so that this ends up being a success story with the rhinos happily released and breeding and growing numbers of the species into the future.
I mean, the clear concern must be that if you release large numbers of rhinos, even over quite a long period of time, like 10 years, which is being suggested, they could be an easy target for poachers. How do you make sure that they're protected?
This is one of the big questions to be addressed. How do we assess the site readiness of the different areas in which to put these rhinos? We know from experience, particularly with black rhinos, of the kind of criteria we need to consider, ensuring that security is good enough, that land tenure is secured, that the habitat is good for the animals, the communities in the area have bought in, the strong political will at a national level. So there are a whole set of measures we already know about to consider. These would need to be revised and updated for these white rhino.
And to what extent do you think within South Africa there is the will and the ability to do all of that?
The majority of white rhinos in the world do remain in South Africa. I think to be successful, this is going to need not only to repopulate ultimately areas such as the Greater Kruger landscape, where rhinos have been lost in recent years, but also to move out into the region. So identifying sites potentially in Zimbabwe, in Zambia, even moving further north. There would need to be these very clear criteria that identify identify what would be the right kind of sites and ensuring that there is sufficient financing available to keep those sites secure into the future. One of the key lessons we've learned from black rhinos from South Africa, but also Kenya and Namibia, is that right now, it's not actually that conservation is limited by the number of rhinos available. It's limited by the amount of suitable, safe space to keep them in. And so we need to make sure those lessons are translated for the white rhino moves.
Joe Shaw from the conservation group Save the Rhino International. In folklore, cuddly Christmas gnomes, the bearded short statues popular in the festive period, are said to give presents to children. But here in Britain, Welsh police are advising locals to be on the lookout after some of these gnomes were left out in people's front gardens. And things might not be what they seem. David Lewis reports.
The soft toys might seem cute, Christmassy, even Santa-like, but they are potentially more sinister than they look. North Wales police are warning locals to be on the lookout for any Christmas gnomes suddenly appearing in their front gardens in Flintshire. Glad tidings they do not bring. Officers say the figurines are possibly being left as calling cards. The strategy is simple. If the decoration is retrieved and removed, someone is in the house and keeping an eye out. If it's uncollected, the property is likely to be empty and therefore easier pickings for any would-be housebreakers in the lead-up to the festive period. Not very Christmassy. The force have now released a photo of one such gnome, complete with red hat and bushy white beard, as a warning. We are aware of a report of individuals in the Broughton area leaving Christmas gnomes in residential front gardens, a police statement said on Facebook. We would advise residents to be vigilant and ensure your home is secure.
David Lewis. K-pop has grown from a Korean musical favourite to an international phenomenon. It is now estimated the industry earns the country around $10 billion a year. But it's not just bands like the famous BTS that are turning K-pop into a valuable export. The choreographers behind K-pop dances are quickly gaining a following well beyond Korea's borders too. Vivian Nunes has been finding out more.
I'm in a gym at a university campus in London. This is where K-Dance Camp is happening all week. About 70 participants have flown in from across Europe to be here. They're paying about $1,300 each to learn from some of the most famous Korean choreographers.
Hi, I'm Marlet. I'm from the Netherlands.
Hi, I'm Celine and I'm from Belgium.
My name is Susie and I'm also from the Netherlands.
I've been a great K-pop fan for like a few years now and I also really love dance. So I just saw this as like the biggest opportunity to really like learn and participate in these classes from these amazing choreographers and dancers.
I really admire them and they inspire me to dance. So I thought that this was a crazy opportunity to actually get a class from them.
It was a business opportunity spotted by Alex Lee.
We have to bring a lot of people from South Korea. We are bringing 8 dancers and also the K-pop company, our staff. It's not an easy job, but we are trying our best.
The 5-day program includes dance classes, meals and accommodation. There's also the chance to audition for a K-pop dance company.
We are going after London. We are going to Berlin to host the camp there. And also we have plans to host in Australia, US and other countries too.
Among the most famous choreographers at the camp is Yeji Kim. She's part of the 1 million dance studio in Seoul.
사실 예전에는 그렇게 크게 느끼진 못했는데 최근 들어서
I feel very proud to be able to do this kind of thing. It's a great experience that I can't feel elsewhere. Going to new countries, meeting new people and sharing the choreography and sharing that energy with fellow dancers, it's very helpful for my future career. It's very valuable.
Well, SNS적으로 되게 도움이 많이 되는 것 같아요.
The 1 million dance studio YouTube channel has 26 million subscribers. The company also has a huge following on TikTok, where dance challenges often go viral, spreading K-pop styles among dance fans worldwide.
That report was by Vivian Nunes. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. Just before we go, the Happy Pod this week is asking for your little win. That's the thing that's happened in your life or where you live that's made your week, no matter how small. We've already had emails from listeners in Arizona, Florida and Australia, and now one from Amanda Tunisin in South Africa, who during a trip whale watching described seeing a great splash just offshore, and suddenly the heart-shaped tail of a whale came sailing out of the water. For the first time in a long time, I can remember I laughed and clapped out loud. Thanks very much for that, Amanda. We'd love to hear all your stories so that we can include them in the podcast this weekend. Drop us an email with your little win to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and you'll hear more in the Happy Pod in this feed on Saturday. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email using the same address. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.